Kia ora, and welcome to Family, Whānau and Disability, a podcast brought to you by Parent to Parent New Zealand. We are here for the many Kiwi families out there caring for a disabled child or family member. We know the journey caring for a disabled or a neurodiverse child is not an easy or a straightforward one. So this podcast is a place to explore the issues that affect us, to share stories, swap tips, and even have a laugh or two. We would love for you to join us each month, so make sure you subscribe. Please also be aware that the views shared are those of the individual and may not represent the views of parent to parent.
Welcome to Connect, Inform, Support on Free FM 89.0. Brought to you by Parent to Parent, the not-for-profit organisation supporting families and whānau of babies, children, teens and adults with any type of disability or health impairment. Inclusive education is the topic of our programme today, and our guests, Justine Brock from Vision Education and Dr. David Wales is also joining us. David is the National Director, Learning Support at the Ministry of Education. I'd like to welcome into the studio Justine Brock from Vision Education, and today we're going to talk about inclusive education. But Justine, what is your role at Vision Education?
Great, well, it's wonderful to be here. I'm a Ministry of Education accredited facilitator, which basically means that I can deliver professional learning and development that is that you can access centralised funding for, and I work to support schools and communities of learning with any kind of aspect, really, including inclusive education, literacy, leadership, cultural responsive pedagogy, all sorts of things, really. Digital technologies, anything.
Tell me, what is inclusive education? And I'm sure that's one monumental question, but just a rough idea of what it is inclusive education.
For me, inclusive education is about valuing diversity. So it's about anybody with diverse needs or having their needs valued, their being seen, that their difference is a positive, not a difficulty. It's where accommodations are made without any kind of vigorous or traumatising advocacy. It's also where anybody who's supporting somebody with special needs or any kind of need like that, it's where they are empowered and supported themselves. So, yeah.
In a school situation then, what makes it inclusive? Does it mean more teacher aides or help for the teacher, or is it just the teacher themselves that is responsible to make it inclusive?
Well, it's incredibly different. It really is centred around the needs of the learner. So in a school, it may be a teacher aide, but it may just be an approach. I'm a great believer in the concept of designing for those in the margins, so therefore it meets the needs of everybody. And so I there's people always say, and it's very, very true, the concept of if we meet the needs of the person with special needs, we meet the needs of everybody in the classroom. So I think it's an approach, but it's also an attitude. It's kind of, I'm going to give it a go. I'm not always going to get it right, but I'm going to be prepared to reflect on what happened and why it happened, and move forward from there as well.
So how does a school become more inclusive? How do they start to become more inclusive?
One of the biggest things is to take an approach of review, self-review, to work out what they're doing that's working, to work out what they're doing that's not working, to gain voice and perspective from other people. So to think about how students feel inclusive, what inclusive looks like for a student, how they understand inclusiveness, what it feels like for their families, what they perceive it to be, the teachers, the school community as a whole, boards of trustees, unpacking it so that everybody develops that shared understanding of where we're at with this, and perhaps seeking some support or through readings or professional development around the principles of being inclusive and what that could look like, and then having a plan of action. You know, how do we get, where do we want to be, and how do we get there?
So if I'm a parent with a disabled child and I go into a school, what am I looking for my child in that school? What am I hoping for? What am I wanting for that child?
So one of the first things that a parent would be looking for is acceptance and valuing. So, and that's of the family as well as the child. So families, everybody has war stories, and it's one of these things in this area of inclusive education. Students have war stories, families have war stories, but teachers and schools and any kind of agency that's engaging with learners with special needs have war stories.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean
things
by
that... Things
that
go wrong,
yeah,
that don't happen.
Absolutely. War stories are all the sad, tragic, upsetting things that can and do happen frequently. The things that people say that offend, the things that people do or don't do, the trauma, and I use, I think rhetoric is really powerful, and I use the word trauma very specifically because after many incidents, if you like, it becomes quite traumatic for people and for all those stakeholders, and so they carry these war stories around with them. If you get a group of parents who have children with special needs in a room, the war stories come out. If you get a group of teachers in a room, the war stories come out. And I would imagine it would be the same if you got a group of psychologists or health professionals in a room as well. So there's a lot of systematic failure, and there's a lot of challenge within the system for people, and people are constantly seeking support. There will be schools who talk about lack of support. There will be parents who talk about lack of support, and there will be students who talk about lack of support. So that's what I mean by war stories. There's a lot of failures that have happened that can be very hard.
So how do you know if you're doing a good job as a teacher in a classroom? How do you feel that you could always do better?
Oh, absolutely, that's the nature of teaching, but
yes.
absolutely, but I think the easiest way for a teacher to know they're doing a good job is around is looking at your student. Are these outcomes, and I mean holistic outcomes, not just academic outcomes, are these outcomes positive? Is my student confident, happy, succeeding, actively participating, expressing themselves? Is there something really special about them that's contributing to the life of our classroom? Am I valuing that? Are they actively showing me what's so special about them? Because sometimes they'll be hiding it if things aren't going so well. All those kinds of things. That's the first place you look. I'd also look at your communication and with your family and in your community, seeing how other people are responding to somebody with special needs is always going to tell you how successful as a school you are. As a teacher, yeah, I can look at my learner in front of me. I can also look at what's happening with my parents and my whānau and community. But I can also look at how we as a school operate. What happens when there's a reliever in the room? What happens when something goes wrong? How do we pull together as a team? You know, all those kinds of things. It becomes successes far more than the student and the teacher. To me, I see this as a community kind of perspective. So if we're looking for success, we should be looking at success as an inclusive school community.
How is inclusive education supported? Big question.
But very, very big question. To varying degrees. There's a lot of information. There's actually probably too much information out there. So there's a lot of information, there's a lot of resources. So you could say that they're supported in the fact that there is a lot out there We have fabulous documents in New Zealand. We have wonderful curriculum and wonderful websites and resources and things. My challenges, as I perceive them, around support systems is the systemic issues. So teachers don't feel supported and empowered. Teachers and learners don't feel supported and empowered. Schools don't, and families don't. So they put their hand up and say, hey, we need some help. And usually one or two things happen. You may get a conversation with someone or a meeting with somebody, and then it may not go much further than that. Or you wait a very long time and not much happens, or you are told, sorry, we don't have the funding, that's not part of our brief, that's not what, you know, we sympathise, we empathise, but we can't help you, kind of thing. And those kinds of stories are common.
Do teachers have to, how do they really match their teaching methods to students with specific needs?
It goes back to that philosophy of what I do for one is going to meet the needs of many. So I have a little analogy about a ramp. So if we're thinking about systems and approaches and teaching approaches that are going to work for students with special needs, we need to design or attack it like we would build a ramp. So we build a ramp for somebody who has mobility issues. And so that might be someone in a wheelchair, and we need a ramp, so we build a ramp. But that ramp is also, so we're building for somebody in the margins, but that ramp's also going to meet multiple needs. So anybody who has mobility issues will use that ramp, whatever those mobilities might be. But not only that, the courier who needs to move a heavy parcel will, with his trolley, will use the ramp. The mother with a pram will use the ramp. Somebody who wants to have fun and put wheels on their feet will use the ramp. Somebody who perhaps has vision issues and depth perception and struggles with stairs will use a ramp. So that's how I kind of see the approach in education, is we identify a need of a learner, we respond with an accommodation that will meet the need of that learner, and that accommodation, more often than not, will meet the needs of other learners within the classroom.
And what about the curriculum? How do you develop a curriculum then that encourages participation? Do you have to change the curriculum a lot, or does that actually work?
Well, all teachers have to meet the needs of their learners. So the whole beauty of being a New Zealand teacher is that teachers are always meeting the needs of their learners, whether they are a special needs learner, a learner whose English is a second language for them, somebody who has come in from overseas and is not used to our system, whatever their needs are, somebody who has a shy personality, someone who has a bold personality, somebody who has sensory needs, all those kinds of things, different academic needs. So teachers in New Zealand are always looking at the diverse needs of their learners and meeting the needs of their learners. That is the way they work. So meeting needs of learners can be challenging if they are very, very diverse, and they may need extra help in that case. And that can be from, it could be anything from a teacher aid to a release time for planning to support to professional development that's going to support them with strategies and new ideas, all sorts of things. But a curriculum being adapted to a learner's needs is a very normal practice in New Zealand classrooms, and that's the way teachers teach. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now, highly relevant to a lot of disabilities is the Universal Design for Learning. Can you tell us about that? How did this start, and does it work with the New Zealand curriculum?
Okay, so it's a research based approach, and it works beautifully with the New Zealand curriculum. It's come through in many different sort of ways, pathways, if you like, certainly through the use of and the integration of digital technology into a classroom and through looking at students with special needs. So there are three main principles. It's basically, it's the ramp analogy that I talked to you about before. That is universal design for learning, design for the margins, and we will meet the needs of everybody kind of thing. It has the representing information in multiple ways, so using multimedia to represent information in multiple ways. So if I learn best by listening to auditory information, having information presented in that way is a really good thing. But if I learn best by listening to watching videos or by reading a text, or there's multiple ways that the information can be accessed, providing me with those different ways so that I can choose or I can repeat my exposure to that information in a different method is something that's going to help me. And so that's something that will meet the needs of all. So that's that kind of thing that I was talking about.
How is it used in the different levels of schooling, primary, secondary schools? How does it have to change for each level of education? How do you use it in a primary school?
Well, it's a very nice fit for a primary school. You would use just about anything you do would be involving multiple ways of exposing children to content. But you'd also, one of the other principles is also around expressing your knowledge and your learning in different ways. So I might express my learning in one form, and we may be learning the same thing, but you would express your learning in a different way. So there's a lot of flexibility within the primary school system for that to happen, and it's certainly something that can be embraced. The challenge with it is simply teachers giving it a go, supporting teachers to understand it, to trial it, to not get it right the first time, and to tweak it and to develop it, and to support teachers to perhaps they could explore it collaboratively or with the support of a professional learning and development facilitator or something like that.
And they basically use it for their own needs and what they see in their classroom, and
absolutely
use parts of it.
You'd use the whole process, but it's just working in perhaps a more flexible way that gives learners more student agency and more choice around driving the way they're working. It fits really nicely with student inquiry and those kinds of things. Yeah.
And what experiences have you had, Justin, professionally? I'd like to ask you personally as well.
Yeah.
But if we start with the professional side of things, what are your experiences of the education?
So professionally, what I have found is that there are inconsistencies when it comes to inclusive education. And now those inconsistencies are within schools and nationally. I guess it's about people, and you can get some people who are working very, very hard, and you can get some schools who are working very, very hard to develop an inclusive environment. But even in some of the best schools, you will find having a conversation with somebody who's in charge of special needs, who would be saying, I can't believe that after that session I ran, this has happened, or this teacher's done this, or this decision's been made, or things like that. So it's not something that we'll always get right, but it's certainly challenging. The best situations that I have seen professionally is when you have people who are passionate, who are solutions-based, who look for alternative ways to make it work, because when the system's broken, you have to be very creative and look for alternative ways sometimes, and that's when we have our biggest successes. There's a lot of passionate teachers and schools out there who are working really hard on this, and then there are some other schools who are struggling with it. Now, I have a perspective on this, and that's around there's an expectation of teachers in schools from the community, I believe, that teachers are expected to be able to identify and even perhaps diagnose learners with special needs. There's an expectation that just because I'm a teacher, I'm an expert in this. And that's truly what parents and families and communities believe. This puts teachers in a position where they feel vulnerable, they feel unsupported sometimes, and they sometimes are in a situation where they have to defend their professional status. Teachers are the first to say, we don't get enough training in this area. They're the first to say, I didn't know this at training college, and when I work with them and facilitate professional development, there's a lot of aha moments that they have, because this might not be a journey that somebody's taken them on before. So the challenge is not that teachers aren't doing a good job in this. It could be that they feel very vulnerable in this situation, and so I would love to see a situation where teachers, instead of having to defend themselves in their practice, they feel empowered, and they feel empowered to be inclusive and to do things a bit differently without being judged or failing, I guess.
And what about personally? What are your personal feelings about inclusive education and your personal involvement in all this?
So I have five children who have diagnosis, three of whom live at home with us, and my husband also has a diagnosis. My personal experience is sometimes quite traumatising. I have a lot of war stories. I have a lot of situations where things have not gone as I believe they should have gone. It's the multiple agencies that you have to deal with. It's the constant advocacy. It's the I talk to a lot of parents about the vulnerability of being labelled as that parent, and you know when you're labelled. You know when you walk into a room and people avoid your eyes or turn around or walk in the other direction. You experience the things that people say to you that are really quite offensive. You're often perceived as wanting special treatment for your child. There's a perception that by advocating for your child, you're getting a lot of people's backs up, and so therefore you can ostracise yourself, and then you start to doubt yourself and you lose a lot of your own confidence because you think, oh, do I go down and talk to the school about this, or is that just going to be another situation where I get their backs up? So do I just sit on this? And you get yourself in this situation where you have to go, you have to build up your confidence, and you're already stressed by the time you go down there. I also find that often families who do need to advocate for their children, not only are they in a stressed situation so that they may not be the best selves that they can be in that situation because they're thinking about all the war stories they're carrying, they're thinking about the fact that their relationship might already be tense already, they're concerned about the situation, they're stressed about how they're coping at home, they're stressed about the three other agencies that they're trying to engage with, all these things are carrying with them. They may also, whether they're diagnosed or undiagnosed, have the similar tendencies to their children because there are a lot of inheritable characteristics and special needs. So they may not have the skill set to be able to negotiate that world or the confidence. They may be experiencing intense anxiety. So when they come down into a school environment, they may not behave in the friendliest or the best way. They may come across as aggressive, or they may come across as too demanding, and they can get the backs up of people. You know, we're all people, we're all relationship based. It can be really complex. It's very hard for schools to deal with parents who are very emotionally involved in their children, advocating for their children, trying to do what's right for their children, but come down and present it in a way that's not conducive to finding a solution. So those kinds of things can happen. The opposite can happen too, where schools are struggling, schools are feeling like they should be coping with this, but they're not. They've reached out to multiple agencies and everybody said, sorry, I can't support you, or sorry, we're full, or we'll put you on a waiting list, or yes, we'll help you, but the help never eventuates, or it's not particularly useful. So schools then are in that situation. So that becomes really problematic, and I've had multiple issues like that for my own learners. It's not uncommon for there to be conversations with schools and teachers where they go, oh yeah, right, like that's going to happen, you know, I'll contact this person for support, and everybody kind of laughs in the room because they know that support could take too long, might not be appropriate, and also might not ever happen. So I have, you know, so many stories like that, like many other parents will have, and so that's really problematic.
Justine, thank you so much for coming in this morning. It has been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for giving us your personal stories, but also the background on inclusive education. It's been great. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Shame to be a
Dr. David Wales is also joining us. David is the National Director, Learning Support at the Ministry of Education. If I just ask you about your role as National Director for Learning Support.
So my position is the National Director for Learning Support, and in this role, my responsibility is to ensure that the education system has good support and processes for all children and young people who have a range of learning needs or barriers to their education. And the idea of learning support is much broader than the former thinking around special education. And the move from special education to learning support is really about trying to move the system from perhaps a binary way of thinking where we used to have regular schools and then a special education system to a more joined up, linked, single system that meets the needs of all learners.
So we have inclusive education. What is meant by inclusive education?
Well, very simply, inclusive education is where all children and young people are present, participating, learning, and actually achieving or making progress as a result of their education. It also means that all students are respected and valued and supported to achieve their potential.
So how important is if a child with a disability goes into the junior school and is working really well and doing really well through that junior school, how important is that transition period when that child goes to intermediate or high school or beyond? How does that happen?
One of the things that we recognised in the recent work that we've done is that the transition points are actually potential points of weakness in our system rather than strengths. One of the things that we were aware of was that actually the supports often stopped and then needed to be restarted at precisely those transition points. So rather than redoubling or increasing the support around a young person and their family as they make that transition from preschool to primary, from primary to intermediate, intermediate to secondary and so on, we found that sometimes the support broke down. So one of the things that we are very keen to change is the way that support is provided across those transitions. And one of the things that we have introduced in the new work we're doing around learning support is the idea of a single plan that essentially follows the child or young person through their education. And provide support at those transition points as well as in between them.
What are the main challenges that schools face? For example, if there are a number of high and special needs children in one classroom, the challenges must be quite huge sometimes for a teacher. They obviously need lots of support. The whole school must be behind this from the principal down. So what are the challenges faced for teachers?
So you raise an important point because it is about how a whole school or indeed how a number of schools may work with the students that they have to provide an inclusive environment. And it does start at the top. Leadership in the school is really important and that's driven by strong leadership from the principal and the senior leaders in the school and the board, but it also comes through to the skills and confidence that teachers have in the classroom. And they need the skills to be able to deal with and help and assist students with, again, a wide range of learning needs.
So they will need people to help, teachers, aides, various people to come in and help with their class. Let's get to the funding for all this. That must be a huge challenge as well.
So funding obviously is important. At the moment, we spend in New Zealand around about $692 million a year on support for those students that we used to think of in terms of special education. So actually the spend is greater when you expand the thinking out to those with wider learning needs. But if we just think about those with who we once thought of in terms of special education, it's around about $692 million. And that has grown by nearly 30% over the last 6 to 7 years. So funding is always an issue, and it's always something that we're conscious of. It is something that we've been successful in getting greater funding to over successive years.
In your role, what have you found has been most successful?
So one of the things that I'm very pleased with is this move from where we were to this idea of learning support. And it allows us to think about the range of needs that young people have, and how best to provide the support for them. We've got an ongoing pilot in the Bay of Plenty, testing out how that translates on the ground, and we're looking to move that out to other places around the country over the course of this year. So I think that's ushering in a really new way of thinking about the needs of young people, how we meet those in the school system, how the system itself is set up to respond to the needs of all young people.
Where to from here?
The new government is clearly taking a close look at the whole of education.
Right.
One of the things that we'll do over the course of this year through the discussions that the government has with the public and that we have with the government is to develop what we're calling an action plan for learning support, and that's something that we'll go back to government on later on this year. So really that is about keeping the momentum going for the work that we've been doing in recent years.
Great. Thank you for your time. I hope we haven't held you up too much.
No, you've timed it really well.
Appreciate your time today. It's been good.
If we can help again in the future, you know, do come back to us and
wonderful,
we'll be able to
David.
Pick up
we
the conversation.
Will. Yeah. We will.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, that's great.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.
Connect, inform, support. Join us next week on Free FM 89.0 for support and information from parent to parent. The program can be downloaded as a podcast, and of course you can get more information on our website, parenttoparent.org.nz.
This has been Family, Whānau and Disability from Parent to Parent. I have been your host, Johanna. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast and that you'll join us again soon.